It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Governor Doug Ducey has decided to change the leadership team in charge of the state's Department of Child Safety. Charles Flanagan, who at least publicly had garnered a lot of praise for the work he'd done, is being replaced by Greg McKay, who's been on loan from the Phoenix Police Department as head of the Office of Child Welfare Investigations. We'll get reaction to Ducey's shifts. Plus, a Brookings Institution paper says Arizona's charter schools are showing mixed results that aren't noticeably better than those of traditional K-12 public schools. I'll talk to one of the researchers and a representative of the Arizona Charter Schools Association. We'll also find out what makes sense when it comes to ranking schools. We start today's program in Prescott, where yesterday the city's residents, including family and close friends, were forced to face the tragic reality that 26-year-old Kayla Mueller was in fact dead, as the Islamic State terrorist group had claimed last Friday. On Tuesday, Mueller's aunt and others expressed their love for her and their sadness at her death. KJZZ's Stina Sieg has been in Prescott since yesterday and joins me now. Hi, Stina.
Hey, Steve.
So, Stina, you had a chance to visit Kayla's high school today. What was that like?
Well, it was a really small high school. It was a small charter high school about 10 miles outside of town. And everyone was really, you know, exceedingly friendly, but they were very, very protective. And you could just tell that, you know, there were some teachers there that had taught Kayla, not a lot that were still there, but there definitely were lots of layers of, you know, protection that the secretary and their HR person was putting in front of me, that you could tell that they just didn't want it to be a public event at their school. And as I was leaving, they were getting a phone call from a Spanish language TV station.
Wow. Is there a feeling, you know, people need to be reminded, I guess, of the fact that the Yarnell Hill fire happened 18 months ago, and that was another tragedy nearby. I guess without getting into people's heads, does there feel like there is a pall, a numbness, that people are just sort of going about their daily business in that public sense, but maybe there's something different going on privately?
I think so. I think that a lot of the pain and the healing is happening behind closed doors. It's not like there's a large banner, you know, downtown saying, "We miss you, Kayla." Like, there's a little sign in the center of town at the main square saying, "Pray for Kayla." And there are some teddy bears and some, you know, some candles and some flowers there. But it's pretty small. It's pretty quiet. And you just get the sense that the pain people are going through, that they want to go through it privately right now. And you've heard people bring up the Yarnell Hill fire, you know, especially because there's so many journalists in town. And people will touch on it, but you can tell that they don't want to go there yet. They want to see how they can heal on their own first.
Stina, Prescott is a place that's known for attracting tourists, Whiskey Row, for sort of being this upbeat, kind of fun town. And no city, no town wants to be known for a tragedy like what happened to Kayla Mueller. Are you picking up that sort of feeling from the residents?
Definitely. When I first got to town, I first spoke with a couple of policemen that were, you know, guarding the press conference that took place yesterday. And they both expressed all this love and sympathy for Kayla Mueller's family. But they also said, you know, God, we wish that our town wouldn't just be known for tragedy. I mean, we've got all these fun events that happen. You know, this is a real destination. This is a place that we really love. And we want people to know that it's not just about the sadness that's taken place, you know, now and in 2013.
KJZZ's Stina Sieg reporting from Prescott in the wake of the tragedy of the death of Kayla Mueller. Stina, thanks very much for giving us the latest. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Governor Doug Ducey's been in office for less than a month, and he hasn't been shy about making personnel changes. That in itself isn't a surprise, but yesterday's move to replace Department of Child Safety Director Charles Flanagan with Greg McKay was not widely anticipated. McKay is the head of the Office of Child Welfare Investigations for what was then known as Child Protective Services, was the person who discovered that thousands of possible child abuse cases had not been investigated. Joining me now with reaction to Governor Ducey's moves is Dana Namark, President and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. Dana, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So what did you think of the job that Charles Flanagan had done? It seemed like he was put in a pretty untenable position there.
He definitely came in during a very large crisis that had very long and deep roots. It had been a long time building. And I think he has laid the foundation, and the new agency has really laid the foundation for reform and for progress and for moving in the right direction.
So is this a case where, as it is in certain positions, where someone comes in, does a good job at that, but maybe wasn't the person to lead it forward, or do you think he could have been that person?
Well, you know, one of the responsibilities of any governor is to choose your cabinet and choose your agency director. So that is the choice the governor made. And I think what's really important is to stay focused on the very same goals for kids and the accountability that we've been asking for a long time. And really the goals need to stay the same, which is reducing caseloads so that the agency can succeed and kids can be safe. And very importantly, slowing down and reversing the growth in the number of kids in foster care.
And certainly those issues are at the core of what we need to talk about. But I do want to ask you a little bit more about personnel. And what do you think about Greg McKay? And what do you know about Vicky Mayo, the deputy director?
Well, Greg McKay, we got to know when he first came on as the head of OCWI, and he's been a police detective and working very actively on child abuse cases. He is a person with amazing personal passion and commitment to child safety. He's very devoted. He's very energetic. I think clearly his expertise and his experience come from one area, which is the criminal investigations, and I think that he realizes that's one piece of the puzzle. And as a director of the entire agency, his job will be to put all the pieces together for child safety, for children having permanent families. So it will have to go far beyond, you know, what his past experience has been.
And as far as Vicky Mayo, the deputy director, many of us don't know much about her. Her most recent job was as vice president of a Scottsdale-based information technology company. But Governor Ducey did have nice things to say about her as far as child advocacy was concerned.
Yes, Vicky is a very energetic and creative and also passionate community advocate for kids. She's done a lot as a private sector volunteer, creating new programs and connecting foster kids with opportunities, connecting them with job skills and jobs. We got to know her when she was part of our leadership academy and went through an intensive training session about child advocacy. And she clearly has put those skills to great use. So I think she will bring, again, a great commitment and energy to this challenge.
Dana, near the end of Governor Brewer's time in office, she had really been outwardly supportive of increasing funding, increasing attention for child welfare and child protection categories like that. Do you think Governor Ducey is showing by these appointments, showing by what he has said, showing by his proposed budget that he is committed as well?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell. His budget largely stuck with the 3-year plan that Governor Brewer had laid out, with a couple of caveats that I'm very concerned about. One is that his budget proposes to zero out the state funding for child care vouchers. These are vouchers that help low-income working families afford safe and reliable child care. And this funding was put in. It's only $4 million, and I say only because it used to be $80 million before the recession. This funding was put in specifically to help slow down the growth in reports of child neglect. When parents can't find safe child care, often children end up in unstable and unsafe situations, and that can lead to reports and examples of child neglect. And that has been the growth in reports to our system. So that $4 million was added to the budget with the recognition, bipartisan across the aisle, that if we invest in that form of prevention, we can slow down the growth and the overwhelming burden on our child protective services system. So we think it's a big mistake to zero that out, and we hope that this new leadership team will work with the governor to recognize that connection and keep that funding in place.
Dana, it sure seems like prevention, for some reason, is a difficult sell, even when it comes to this, even after what we've seen with the criticism, and rightfully so, of CPS. So why is prevention something so difficult? Is it, when it comes to money, does there have to be this proof and then we can react to it, as opposed to saying, let's make sure this doesn't happen, or at least prevent it as much as we can?
Yeah, I think, Steve, as you know, the political process operates on very short-term time cycles. So Each budget is a one-year cycle. Legislative terms are 2 years. It's very short term. Prevention, you measure and you see the payoff longer term. So it's a hard sell, partly because the time cycles are different. It's also a hard sell because it is hard to prove, right, what would have happened. So to be able to show what would have happened if we had investments in prevention, we have lots and lots of data, and we've been sharing that, and we feel like that conversation had a lot of momentum in 2014, and that is exactly why lawmakers put that funding in.
Dana, this is another tough question, I suppose, to quantify with an answer, but do you think based on February 2015, as opposed to, let's say, February of 2013, that Arizona's kids are in better shape because of some of the decisions made and some of the funding added related to protecting children?
No, I don't think they're yet in better shape. Okay. I think we have laid the groundwork. And what I want to point out is that some of the decisions Governor Brewer made early in her term contributed to the crisis, and then she had to work to fix that later. We certainly want to work with Governor Ducey to avoid that same mistake.
Dana Nemark is president and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. Dana, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about a Brookings Institution study on the uneven performance of Arizona's charter schools. And then later on this hour, the NBA's at the All-Star break. So how have the Suns been doing? We'll find out. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by SRP. Doubling the size of their community solar program with power from a new solar facility in the valley. More at srpgrid.com. SRP, delivering more than power.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ. Coming up in the next hour of Here and Now in the noon hour, fighting rages on in eastern Ukraine, even as leaders prepare for peace talks. Officials in Kiev say 19 Ukrainian soldiers were killed today. We'll have an update for you. Also, how Pepsi and Coca-Cola are grappling with shrinking demand for soda pop. Those stories and a lot more coming up in the next hour of Here and Now. A bright sunny day for you. We're looking at clear skies this afternoon in Phoenix and the Valley with a high temperature today near 80 degrees. Right now in Flagstaff, it's 43. Tucson has 71, and it's 70 degrees in downtown Phoenix. This is KJZZ. The time is 11:19.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona has been a leader in the development of charter schools, but as currently constituted, is that a good thing? The Brookings Institution recently released a paper called The Uneven Performance of Arizona's Charter Schools. Matthew Chingos, a senior fellow in government studies at Brookings Brown Center on Education Policy, was one of the project's researchers, and he joins me now from Washington, D.C. Matthew, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for telling us more about this. You focused on charter middle schools. Why did you go in that direction?
So we focused on middle schools because we can look at kids before they enter middle school and find kids who have the same characteristics, but some went to charter middle schools while the others went to traditional public middle schools, and then track their performance. Does one group, on average, do better or worse over time? Whereas if we were to look at elementary schools, which we also do in the paper, but we don't put as much stock in the results, kids aren't tested until, say, third grade. So you would miss any impact the charter or traditional public school had on them before the testing started.
You found, this phrase really struck me in reading at least the abstract of it, you found some very large positive and negative impacts on testing in charter schools that aren't as common in traditional schools. Can you explain that?
Wait, so what we found, if you look at the average, on average the charter schools are doing about the same or in subjects a little worse than the traditional public schools. But then we didn't just look at the average, we looked at the whole distribution. We looked at for outliers. Was it the case that there was more variation in the charter sector than in the traditional public sector? And we found out that there was. And what that means is that even though on average they're about the same or the charters are a little worse in some subjects, at the extremes there are more charters. So there are more very good charters than very good traditional public schools, but there are also more very bad charters than very bad traditional public schools.
Well, do you have, I know you do, so I'm sort of asking a loaded question here. Do you have certain recommendations or certain things that you've seen that would make that that stark difference narrow a little bit?
Well, I'm not sure we necessarily want it to narrow. Part of the point of the charter sector is to have space for innovation. But you need to have that room for innovation, but also some accountability so that schools that innovate but in ways that are not successful aren't allowed to stick around. And we actually find some pretty compelling evidence that charter schools that shut down look a lot worse in terms of student performance than charter schools that are allowed to remain open. But if you look in the traditional public sector where, you know, regular public schools do shut down sometimes, the ones that shut down are really not very much worse on average than the ones that stay open. So it suggests that there is more going on in the charter sector that should drive average improvement in quality over time, but perhaps we need more of that given that the on average results don't look so good.
And in what subject areas did it seem that charter schools were especially weaker or especially stronger?
Well, the answer to that is really it depends. You have to look at the pay. It depends on the type of charter school and on the grade level. So I'd refer folks to the full paper. But one thing I can tell you is that the negative effects did seem to be concentrated in non-urban charter schools. So the charter schools in urban areas seem to do about the same as traditional public schools in urban areas. But outside the urban areas, say in the suburbs and rural areas, the charters tended to do a bit worse.
Now, based upon what you looked at, and I wonder, just based on what I read, does it feel like charter schools and traditional schools have similar strengths and shortcomings, even if they're not identical? Are they similar, and is this something of a pattern in when it comes to K-12 schools and our education system?
So this was a pretty high-level look just at overall performance. We didn't go into these schools and find out what are they doing differently. But one thing we did do was we looked at the mission statements of the charter schools, and we wanted to see, do charters with certain stated missions do better or worse than others? And what we found was that charters that had what we termed a rigorous mission, meaning they sort of said we were no excuses kind of school, a school focused on academic achievement, those schools tended to do better than traditional public schools in math, but about the same in reading. Whereas schools that said they focus more on the arts tended to do worse in academic subjects on those tests than students at traditional public schools. And that makes sense because a school that's focused on the arts, it shouldn't be that surprising that students there perhaps do a little bit less well on math and reading if that's not the focus.
Is there the potential for a have and have not situation, which is what some people, at least in Arizona, perhaps in every state, criticize when it comes to traditional K-12 public schools, the idea that those in wealthier areas of a city will then have parents who are more involved? That's perhaps a stereotype which isn't fair, but is there that perception, and does that also apply to charter schools?
I think there's a real concern that a lot of families don't have the choices that other families have, and charters are one way to address that fact, right? In this country, folks who can afford it can go to any school, send their kid to pretty much any school they want to. They can pay private school tuition. They can buy a house in the neighborhood with a good local public school. Where families with less resources, less income, can't do that. So charters is one way to provide more choices by creating schools that are not tied to where you live. But we could also have other forms of school choice. We could have open enrollment within districts. So students could go to any public school in the district, not just the ones where their parents can afford to pay the high rent or the high price for a fancy house.
And Matthew, one other thing as well which struck me, and what regulations are there? Should there be more regulation of charter schools? And what kind of improvement could that make? In the paper, you mentioned this idea that perhaps a review of charter school results more frequently would help.
I think a more frequent review would help. I think we want to be careful if there's too much regulation, that kind of kills the whole point of charter schools, which is to have less regulation and more room for innovation. But as I said earlier, I think that has to be tied to accountability for results. So the charter schools that are being successful, measured in part by test scores, but also other things, such as how students are doing later on for high schools, whether students are graduating and going to college. The ones that are making the good results ought to be allowed to stay and to expand their operations, and those that aren't hacking it need to be shut down.
Is there a trend when it comes to charter schools across the country? Are we seeing more of them? Obviously, this paper was focused on Arizona, which has been a pioneer in charter schools, but ultimately, going forward, is that something that more states are interested in expanding?
We are seeing more and more charter schools. Nationwide, the most recent data, which are from a couple of years ago, a little under 5% of students were in a charter school, whereas in Arizona, it's 13%. But there has been growth both in Arizona and nationwide in recent years. So as states lift the caps on the number of charter schools allowed, I think we're going to see more and more of them.
Would you be willing to posit an opinion about whether and how that could change the K-12 system?
I think part of the hope behind charter schools is not only will they innovate and be kind of laboratories to figure out what works, but also that they'll provide some needed competition for the traditional public schools. That instead of being guaranteed, all the kids, particularly the kids from low-income families who can't move to the higher performing school attendance area or school district, that competition could be a good thing and perhaps a rising tide that lifts all boats.
Matthew Chingo, Senior Fellow in Government Studies at the Brookings Institution's Brown Center on Education Policy. He's the co-author of a very interesting paper called The Uneven Performance of Arizona's Charter Schools. Matthew, thanks.
Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. There are all kinds of rankings when it comes to K-12 education. Many national lists rank Arizona's K-12 system quite low when it comes to performance and per-student funding. The Arizona Department of Education ranks the state schools and gives them letter grades. Various websites also give their opinions on schools around the Valley and state. But unlike the criteria each of us may place when it comes to what restaurants or movies we prefer, school rankings could and should have a broader meaning. With me to talk about school rankings and what criteria makes sense is Pearl Chang Esau, President and CEO of Expect More Arizona. Hi, Pearl. Thanks for being
Steve.
Here.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So when we measure the effectiveness of schools, what are some standards, what are some criteria you think are most vital?
Yeah, there's a number of factors that we would encourage folks to look at. And certainly the average test scores of a school, that's probably what's most commonly noted when it comes to school rankings. And that usually looks at the average of the students and their on the state test. And that factors into our school letter grade that you mentioned. And one thing we really love to point to with the state test, if you're going to be looking at the test scores, is also looking at growth. Because it doesn't just, growth makes sure to take into account how well school's actually making progress with kids and moving those students that are maybe performing at the bottom and pushing them and encouraging them to make progress. There's certainly many ways to look at test scores, but we would also say it really goes beyond that, you know, and there are a number of really important factors that tell the story of the quality of a school, the culture of a school that goes far beyond tests. And one of the most important things would probably be the leadership, you know, making sure that as a parent, you have the opportunity to visit a campus and get a sense of what the culture is like. Do they hold high expectations for all students? What's the culture of, you know, the teachers? Are kids having fun when they're learning?
Pearl, to me, that's so fascinating because I think when we look at the core of things, I mean, I know that there has to be some sort of standard measurement. When you talk about testing and numbers, and I get that, because that's how we go forward. Maybe that's even how funding is determined. But when it comes down to what kids are really learning, aren't we missing something if we just look at numbers?
Yes, I think we are. I mean, I think the test scores are a proxy, and they're a very useful tool because they give us, it's kind of like going to the doctor for a checkup. You know, they kind of give a sense of how are we doing. If, you know, with as most parents that I know, and I'm a parent myself, you know, you do look at much more than the test scores because there's often a story underneath what you're just seeing from the numbers. And that, again, is it's hard to discern that without actually being on a school campus and talking to the people who work there. I would also really encourage folks to talk to parents and students and get a sense of what the community feedback is for the school.
School choice, obviously, is a good thing. Certainly the phrasing of it is. I mean, people love the idea of choice. How much does that complicate things? I mean, you talk about talking to students, talking to teachers. When parents have the opportunity, how much more work does that require of them? And are enough parents involved enough to make the right choices?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's really a good thing that parents have choices in our state. And we're fortunate in the sense that, you know, if parents have the wherewithal to consider all the various factors, you do see a lot of parents who are looking for information. And we have a compilation on Expect More Arizona's website of the various school rankings, you know, that parents could go take a look at. But at the same time, I think it really highlights the responsibility we have of looking at maybe our parents who don't have those resources, who don't necessarily know what to look for, You know, for those parents, you know, I really think choice probably isn't really choice unless they have, unless they know what they're looking for. So I think that overall choice is a good thing because it does let us put our kids in places that are personally and individually going to be right for them.
When you hear the broad scope of how Arizona compares to other states, again, are there different criteria you look at? Because we see certain rankings, we see per pupil funding, we also see how test scores go. Is that measurement even more difficult state to state as opposed to in-state?
Yeah, I think that when we're looking at Arizona schools, it's helpful to just, it's helpful to know the comparison to other states, certainly. I mean, one of the things that we hear the most often is that Arizona has some of the lowest per pupil funding of any state in the country. That is a meaningful point. You know, I wouldn't throw that out the window and say, oh, you know, funding doesn't matter and we can't just throw money at the problem. Funding is really important. But so is the strategic use of that funding. And so it's kind of two parts. It's one is, you know, we need to make sure that we're supporting our schools with the resources that they need. But there also needs to be the leadership and the human capital, you know, that we need to make sure that we have great principals, great teachers, great programs that are making effective use of that funding.
Pearl, are there ways that you've seen that Arizona steps that Arizona has taken to get that way, or have you heard of other places that are doing that better so that our leadership continues to get better and better?
Absolutely. I am so proud of the progress that Arizona students and teachers have been making. They have been doing an incredible job. We have raised our academic standards here. We implemented a high-stakes move-on-when-reading law here. There's been a number of steps that we've taken to try to improve the quality of our education. And as a result, the Quality Counts report showed last year that Arizona actually ranked fourth in closing the reading gap for our students, and we ranked eighth on our fourth grade math performance. So we're doing incredible things. We have great examples of both public district and charter schools all across the state that have made significant progress, particularly for students from low-income backgrounds. I would say that the current culture that we have in our schools has been challenging, though, because we have raised the bar, we've raised standards, we've raised expectations, we've created more accountability, yet we've been cutting resources. And so parents have seen class sizes grow, they've lost their librarians, their nurses, their teacher aides. That kind of environment is unsustainable. You know, we have 50% of our teachers now leaving in their first 5 years of the profession. So if we want to continue to see these gains that we have been seeing, and we want to hit the top rankings on those national reports, we've got to make education more of a priority.
Pearl, last question for you, and this relates to going forward. As you mentioned, the funding challenges and how that affects everything. Perception versus expectations. Arizona's had that perception of not being in a good place. So how much more of an effort is there that has to change that perception? And then on top of improving performance, does that make it even more of a challenge?
Yeah, I think it's both. The problem is both that we need to probably do a better job of sharing the wonderful things that are happening in our state in education. We have some of the best high schools in the country. Those are both districts and charters. They serve low-income students. I mean, we've got some incredible things going on. But at the same time, the perception is what it is for a reason. I mean, there is very much a sense that Arizona hasn't made education enough of a priority. And what we really want to focus on is excellence and opportunity for all. And I really think that's what it comes down to at the end of the day, is it's not just spotlights of excellence are great, but until we have achieved that level of excellence for an opportunity for all of our kids, we haven't done enough.
Pearl Chang Esau is president and CEO of Expect More Arizona. Pearl, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Earlier this hour, we talked about a Brookings Institution study about Arizona's charter schools. Now I'm joined for a few minutes by Dr. Ildi Lasko-Kerr, Vice President of Academics for the Arizona Charter Schools Association. Doctor, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm curious about, there's one point made in the Brookings Institution study about perhaps having more frequent reviews of charter schools to make sure they're performing at a high level. What are your thoughts about that generally?
Well, actually, the state agency that authorizes the majority of charter schools in Arizona began doing that in 2012. Mm-hmm. They conduct annual reviews of schools' academic performance, holding them to really rigorous standards, and then conduct more detailed reviews every 5 years a charter is in operation.
And what difference do you think that could make? I know it's only been since 2012. What difference do you think you're seeing so far?
I think we already saw the difference in our latest letter grades that were published in 2014, where we saw 73% of our charter schools that had 2 years of their letter grades either improved their letter grade or earned an A rating by the state. And that included our alternative schools as well as our traditional schools. And I think that's due in large part to the rigorous accountability that they're being held to.
There's certainly a great variety of charter schools in Arizona. The state's a pioneer when it comes to that. How important is the specific mission of each school in terms of making sure that they're accomplishing the greater, accomplishment when it comes to academics? When a school focuses on the arts, can that be measured differently in the broader sense, and how important is that?
Yeah, I think mission fit is a really important element in the choice market, both for parents who are choosing to send their children to particular types of schools that have, you know, a mission, whether it's arts or college prep. But that mission really should be driving all of the educational decisions that they make in terms of the programs that they provide for their students. And that clearly translates to what's being assessed on our state assessment, which is at this point very limiting into math and reading. And while we know that a well-rounded child is likely to do well on, you know, general measures of achievement, our state assessment's really focused on math and reading, and so trying to figure out where we balance the information that we share with parents, I think, is important.
Dr. Lasko-Kerr, I want to read you a couple sentences from the Brookings Institution study just to get your reaction. Even though the average charter has a zero or negative impact on test scores, there are more charters with very large positive or very large negative test score impacts than there are in traditional public schools. What do you make of that?
Well, that's really consistent with our own research that we conduct here in Arizona. In part, that's due to the point that you made earlier about that mission of the school. So we've got charter schools that really focus on rigorous college prep, advanced, academic focus, which I think represents that high, very positive outcomes. But we also have a very large population of our charter schools that focus on serving the needs of students who are incarcerated youth or pregnant and parenting teens. Those kids that are significantly behind academically, almost 22% of our charter schools in Arizona are considered alternative schools. And I think that accounts for a large part, that large part of that lower achieving group of students or schools in that study.
At its core, do you think charter schools and their general mission are understood by the average Arizona?
I don't think that most parents and just members of the community understand. In particular, people need to know that charter schools are independently run, publicly funded schools that receive state funds, but have a high level of expectation to hold themselves accountable. And I think that piece is often misunderstood.
Final question for you has to do with funding. Obviously, traditional schools are concerned about funding. We're seeing how that could potentially affect things with Arizona facing another budget shortfall. How about charter schools? How concerned are you?
You know, funding is always a concern. On average, charter school students are funded to a tune of almost $1,200 less than their district counterparts. In part, that's due to a really antiquated system of school finance that we have here in Arizona. And so obviously, resources to support the needs of students, in particular those that are most at risk, are critical for us to change the landscape of education here in Arizona.
Dr. Ildi Lasko-Kerr is Vice President of Academics for the Arizona Charter Schools Association. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at the new head of the Kyle Center for Water Policy at the Morrison Institute at ASU. What are some of Arizona's biggest water challenges? Plus, it's the NBA All-Star break, so how are the Suns doing? We'll find out more coming up. This is KJZ.
KJZZ is supported by Thailicious, offering traditional dishes like pad thai, penang curry, and a variety of vegetarian dishes. Located at Ray and Kyrene in Chandler, menu and online ordering available at thailiciousaz.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Hope you can join us after 12 noon as Here and Now continues from NPR and WBUR in Boston. And today, coming up, we'll be hearing from the New York Times food critic, Mimi Sheraton. She'll be talking about her latest book, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. I don't want to give you the whole list, but a couple of the foods include frozen Milky Way candy bars and also caviar. Check it out. That's coming up on Here and Now here on KJZZ. No traffic problems to report at this hour. Things moving fairly smoothly right now. We'll have another update about 20 minutes away. It's going to be sunny and warm in the valley today with a high near 80 degrees. It's now 70 degrees downtown Phoenix. This is KJZZ. The time's 11:41.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. With a powerful drought in full effect and the reality of living in a desert, the huge question of what to do about water in Arizona hangs over multiple elements of policy and our everyday lives. A new participant has been brought into the mix in how to deal with water challenges. As the Kyle Center for Water Policy at ASU's Morrison Institute has come on board, Sarah Porter, an attorney and former executive director of Audubon Arizona, is the inaugural director of the Kyle Center, and she joins me now. Sarah, in moving forward, how does Arizona balance its reputation, both for being forward-looking on water planning, while also not calling on us as everyday people to conserve more?
Good for you to see or to understand that Arizona has done a huge amount of planning, careful planning, and that's part of our history in Arizona. We've been doing that kind of careful planning for 100 years. And we do it because we're an arid state, and water is central to everything we do, to our economies, to our way of life, to the way we organize our communities. So it's in our nature to do that careful planning. And in many ways, you know, as a native Arizonan, I can say we should be very proud of the people who have been involved in that water planning. And it goes from the municipal level all the way up to a statewide level. But as for conservation and other kind, that's one kind of water supply planning. There are parts of the state that do very visible conservation. People in Tucson are rightly very proud of the way they incorporate xeriscaping throughout their community. Other parts of the state do other kinds of conservation. Many cities have codes, municipal codes, that require water efficient fixtures and other kinds of conservation measures. In general, we haven't had a focus on conservation that involves household conservation, and that's kind of a big optic for people. In the city of Phoenix, and Phoenix often gets criticized, or people from Phoenix get criticized, because we still have grass lawns and we have even operable fountains in some parts of the city. In reality, the amount of water that could be saved through those conservation methods, even though that kind of conservation is very important for many, many reasons, but even if we went all out and saved all the water we could, we wouldn't be addressing our state's biggest water needs. So while I don't want to take away at all from the importance of our personal efforts to conserve, and there are a lot of reasons why it's really great to incorporate some native landscaping in our yards. When we're talking about our water supply for our state for the next 100 years, we have to have a conversation that's bigger than whether or not, you know, we grow Bermuda grass or we grow native Sonoran plants in our yards.
Where does technology come into this as we advance and get better at not only preserving water, but using it more efficiently?
Technology is very important. In the city of Phoenix, over the last few decades, demand for water has held steady, in part, not totally, but in part because of technology that creates water efficiency. When we look to the future, there's really very little question that we're going to have to figure out some ways to augment our water supply. And it's technology that will allow for augmentation. One of the kinds that people often talk about is desalination, which is something that's being used in other parts of the world. And again, that's a technology that's improving all the time.
Considering what Mother Nature or the natural environment holds for us here, is this a realistic place as far as sustainability goes? And how much is that going to be into what you're interested in looking into, who you're interested in talking to about making sure that over the next century, Arizona is as ready as any area can be some people are talking even more about climate change and how that may affect areas that are in a desert like this.
That needs to be incorporated into our plan because we have to plan for, you know, the worst case scenarios. Sustainability is a kind of a loaded term, and it means a lot of people, a lot of things to a lot of people. And I would say that the real question when we're talking about water and our long-term water planning should be, we should be looking at what kind of Arizona do we want? And we need to think about it. And that's a complicated question. We need to talk to a lot of people, but we know that we have to figure out how to get the water we need for the kind of Arizona we want. Water is the driving force of our economy. It's just it really is the principle of organization of our state. And so sustainability kind of begs the question. The question is, what sort of future do we want? Mm-hmm. Where do we want to grow? There's very little question that our population will grow. How do we want it to grow? Where do we want it to grow? How will we get water to those places? And then the big question is, are we willing to make the investments that are required in order to build that future?
Based on what you know, do you think enough people, whether it's our state lawmakers, whether it's the people we elect to statewide government or in Congress, is there enough attention paid to this issue of water, regardless of what people feel like the next step should be?
I don't. And I wouldn't be in this job if I felt that everybody knew enough about water and worried enough about water. I think we need a broader engagement statewide at the grassroots voter level as well as at the decision maker and policy maker level. Water's a really complicated subject, and maybe for that reason, it may seem not fascinating, and it really is fascinating, or maybe it seems daunting to people. But for some reason, many, many people aren't really aware of what our real water issues are. And it's something we need to get beyond, because we all need to be engaged in this discussion about what kind of future do we want. How are we going to pay for the water projects that will enable us to have the kind of state that we want to have for our children and our grandchildren for generations to come, as well as not to overlook parts of this, you know, the sectors that aren't necessarily at the table. And an example would be the environment. How do we plan to protect the places that we love as Arizonans and make sure that they have enough water too? So it's our cities, our beautiful natural areas, the parts of our economy that really define Arizona, agriculture, industries, our, you know, communities. How do we make plans to have enough water for the people that are going to be here?
Are you going to have to be a salesperson in the sense to make people realize, okay, this is important?
I'd rather think of myself as a coach than a salesperson.
Okay.
But I think that's part of what the Kyle Center wants to do. We want to be pulling people in to look at possible solutions to our water challenges and then get those proposals out there, get people to think about them, talk about them, ask questions about them until we feel that we have consensus on the direction that we want to go.
Can this be a grassroots-driven thing? Or when you talk about talking with the stakeholders and getting that expertise, does the issue then have to go to the policymakers? I mean, do you have to get to the table with them, not you necessarily,
yeah,
but just the
yeah.
idea, and say, okay, this is the Arizona that a lot of people want, so this is, you need to consider this in your next session or whatnot.
Yeah, there's no question that we need to engage our policymakers. We're already working on that a little bit. It's early days. I've only been in my job 3 weeks, I think.
Right.
But without question, we need Arizona's policymakers, and it's a range of people from agency officials to elected officials, but we need broad engagement at that level.
Sarah, finally, you're concerned about the role of the Arizona Department of Water Resources, how much funding that agency is receiving. What more do we need to know?
Whether the agency that is responsible for so much of planning Arizona's water future is adequately resourced. So that agency is the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Currently, their budget and their staffing is at about half of what it was before the Great Recession, about 2008. This agency is responsible for providing a huge amount of technical expertise in order to help move along the resolution of this massive litigation called the General Stream Adjudications. That litigation has been going on for 40 years. ADWR is also responsible for being Arizona's representative, essentially, at negotiations regarding Colorado River water. And we share that water with seven states. Looming out there is the fact that we're in the 15th year of a historic drought. I doubt that very many Arizonans wake up in the morning and think, yeah, that Department of Water Resources, I'm really concerned. And yet, so much of what happens for our water supply and consequently for our future depends on making sure that ADWR has enough resources to be able to do its work.
Sarah Porter is director of the new Kyle Center for Water Policy at the Morrison Institute at ASU. Sarah, thanks for coming in.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last season, the Phoenix Suns were a pleasant surprise for anyone who follows the team. The roster had some up-and-coming players and a lot of unknowns, along with a new general manager and coaching staff. The Suns didn't make the playoffs, but they did win an impressive 48 games. This season's pace is a little slower than that, but they're in the playoff hunt and would be the Western Conference's eighth seed if the season ended today. Which it doesn't, of course. So why are Suns fans so angst-ridden and feeling snake-bit? Andrew Sharp is a staff writer for Grantland and wrote a piece about the Suns recently, and he joins me now. Andrew, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
How are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm good. The piece you wrote was really interesting, going down certain points about maybe how Suns fans should feel, some things that are going well and not so well. The Suns were a hugely pleasant surprise last year, winning games, playing an exciting brand of basketball, and yet, like I said, this season feels like a disappointment. So should it?
I don't think it should. I think the way last year played out, they sort of surpassed everyone's wildest dreams, and the natural progression obviously is to then build on what happened last year, which is narrowly missing the playoffs. But I think what's happened this year is they lost some key players, and the rest of the conference is so tough that it's tough to expect them to do much better than last year. And it's more the core that they have there and the assets that they have for the future, which sort of keep hope alive. And I think given who they lost, you would have expected more of a step back than they've taken so far this year.
But conventional wisdom being what it is, there are people who will look at that roster and say, you know, maybe 1-9, 1-10, it's one of the better rosters in the NBA, but they don't have that star player. They have guards Eric Bledsoe, Goran Dragic, that people think really highly of. Is the NBA still a league where if you don't have one of those top-level stars, you're not going to win enough games, you're not going to get referee calls as well?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that's one of the things that I would be most excited about if I were a Suns fan. You look at teams like the Atlanta Hawks and even to some degree the Golden State Warriors, they don't have like a traditional LeBron James, Kevin Durant type superstar who just sort of dominates all by himself. And even the Spurs last year showed that like a team that has top to bottom five or six guys who can really score, and that if that team can move the ball, they can be just as deadly as anyone. And I think that's what's so amazing about watching the Suns is their ability to compete, even though they don't really have the traditional weapons that most of the best teams in the West do. And the rest of the West is sort of loaded this year.
Andrew, I think primarily because the team gets a lot of technical fouls, it's considered to be a pretty immature team. When a team is that young and most of its top players are still pretty inexperienced, how much more challenging does that make the job of head coach Jeff Hornacek, who, you know, gets great marks? People who have been Suns fans for years remember him as a shooting guard and a really good team here as well. Is there that feeling that the players will still listen to him if they keep losing these ridiculously close games, for example?
I think hopefully it's sort of a growing pain thing with him, because I know he's butted heads with a couple of the players over the technical foul issue, and he actually instituted a policy where he benches someone after a technical, and I think that sort of Hornacek working through things with the players, and eventually they'll sort of come to an agreement there. But I don't think it's a concern at all. I think this is just sort of comes with the territory when you're dealing with a roster full of guys who are young and still learning how to be a really good team. I mean, you look at guys like Eric Bledsoe and Marquise Morris, and even Isaiah Thomas is still pretty young. And just across the roster, everyone's still sort of learning what it takes and when you can lose your composure and when you really can't lose your composure.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of what Hornacek is trying to impart as we go here.
The Suns have gotten a lot of attention for playing three point guards at a time. You mentioned Isaiah Thomas and Eric Bledsoe. I mentioned Goran Dragic before.
It's crazy to watch them with their three point guards.
Yeah, but when you watch it, it almost feels like can a team win for longer than, let's say, 5 or 6 minutes with that lineup, unless you have, you know, like a Bill Russell or a Shaq behind there to sort of protect against the defensive shortcomings there.
And I think that's the ultimate. I think that's the ultimate question, and the answer may be no. In terms, if you're talking about competing for not just a playoff spot, but competing for the top of the West, it might be a little bit too gimmicky for them, and they may have to spend the money that they would spend bringing back Goran Dragic on. They may have to spend that money on someone else this summer. And the nice thing, the smart thing about the Suns is that this past summer, adding Isaiah Thomas was a big risk, but it's mostly paid off. After some sort of hiccups early on, they've really found a groove. And now if they decide that keeping Dragic and paying a bunch of money to bring him back doesn't make the most sense, then they have a plan B, and they can still run a two-guard lineup that is just as terrifying to try and defend as the three-guard lineup.
Andrew, it looks like the team has been in a slump. They've lost 5 of 6. Now, one of those was one of those heartbreaking sort of end-of-game losses. But there was some speculation after last night's game that this might be the last time you see this current Suns roster together. Is that a sign of fan impatience, or All-Star break is going to be lasting for more than a week, possibility of any trades?
Yeah, there's definitely always a possibility that they'll try to make a deal. And I think, first of all, I feel like all my Suns optimism jinxed the Suns season because it sort of spiraled a little bit. But yeah, I think definitely, like I said in the piece, there's definitely a sense that this is a bit of a transition year, and with the rest of the conference getting older, it makes sense to try and position yourself however you can to be best off over the next few years, rather than just looking at just specifically this season. So I think Ryan McDonough, the GM in Phoenix, I think if he sees a move that will either maybe free up salary for this summer when someone like Kevin Love may be available, or if he sees a move that can sort of improve the Suns down the stretch, like there's definitely a chance he'll make a switch over the next week or so.
Andrew, very briefly, in about 15 seconds, do the Suns hold on to their playoff spot or no?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I want them to. They've been so much fun to watch all year, but I think that the Thunder and the Pelicans are both too good, and it's just going to be too hard for them to compete over the next 6 weeks or so.
Andrew Sharp, a staff writer for Grantland. He wrote a piece about the Suns recently. You can find it online at grantland.com. Andrew, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for listening to today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry, also Chris Furphy, for their help on today's program. If you'd like to hear any of our segments again, go online this afternoon to kjzz.org. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon.
KJZZ is supported by Hospice of the Valley, a not-for-profit hospice providing medical, social, emotional, and spiritual support to patients and family facing end of life. Serving the Valley since 1977. HOV.